It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. A comprehensive new analysis by the New York Times shows that child poverty has plummeted since 1993, a 59% drop. But that doesn't mean our country has solved poverty by any stretch. Nearly 38 million Americans are poor today. That's from the Census Bureau's Poverty in the U.S. report published last week. Many other people above the poverty line struggle to afford a decent life. Let's take stock of the decline. Hear from a leader who is working on this issue. Join in 800-642-1234. George Hinton is here, CEO of Milwaukee's Social Development Commission. It's a community action agency focused on helping and advocating for people in Milwaukee County living in poverty. George, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Thanks for having me. I'm excited to be here and having a discussion with you and the community.
Yes, well, the data tell us child poverty has fallen sharply in recent decades. Can you feel that on the ground in your work over the decades trying to lift people out of poverty?
Well, you know, with the recent funding that's come out of the federal government due to the pandemic, there has been a decrease in children who are experiencing a shortage of food. I don't think that's something that's sustainable in the future, because once that type of funding goes away, we're going to be right back where we were prior to 2019. And then the other thing to remember is, you know, my concern is it doesn't necessarily hasn't really necessarily moved anyone out of poverty, but it has provided some level of a safety net for our children. And a lot of that came through feeding children through our school systems. And with the disruption of our schools and their ability to see children face to face, it also put us in a very, very interesting position where the federal funding actually had to take place to make sure that the children didn't go hungry from that perspective.
Let's look at that a little bit more closely there, because as our economy first ground to a halt in COVID, the poverty rate, according to this data, continued to decline. And that's interesting. So what impact did federal relief efforts like the rounds of stimulus checks and the expanded child relief tax credit, what impact did they have on families in poverty?
Well, I think it stabilized the situation where children who are used to going to school and maybe getting a free lunch or being in daycare and receiving meals through that process, it ensured that there was some food available for families and dollars and funding available for families to ensure that the children were not impacted as hard as they could have been if that had not have happened. To be quite honest, if that had not have happened, that number would have shot way up in the other direction. And it would not have been very good for any of our communities across the state.
How serious is the problem of economic hardship for Milwaukee area families and across our state? Can you give us a glimpse?
Well, you know, we talk a lot about food and our children, but parents continue to struggle with how to balance basic living expenses. For example, quality affordable housing is taking a huge chunk of the funding that they do have. And then you put on top of it, if they're not quality homes, then you have this burden of energy and how much it costs. As we know from the time to time, even transportation now with the increase in the cost of gasoline, those may seem insignificant increases, but when you're trying to get back and forth to work and trying to maintain some semblance of control over your life, that becomes competing issues that when you don't have enough funding, you have to make choices. And so most parents will choose to feed their children best they can. But then that puts a burden on them being able to pay for their homes, pay for transportation, get to work, and pay for the energy, and just put clothes on the kids' back and things like that. So it's still a problem. I would say it's worse over the last, it's getting worse because of the increase of cost of housing. We don't have enough, we didn't have enough affordable housing prior to the pandemic. But the inflation of paying rent and even home ownership, has made a huge impact, on, the safety net, the ability to just manage the money that you have, whatever that is.
It goes, it sounds like it's not just about food and measuring that. It's about housing and transportation. It's about childcare, medical costs. There are so many compounding costs. And then you put on top of that inflation, that too, I would imagine, and geographical differences in the cost of living. That all, I would imagine, is part of this calculation.
Oh, yes. And even though wages are going up, the price of everything else is outpacing the wage increases. And while I believe that's good that wages are going up, we have to find ways to control other types of costs so that that becomes a true gain for our citizens in the United States, because we do need to get we are carrying too much poverty in this country. Considering our size and the wealth of our country, you would think that we should be doing much better. And there is many examples across the world, and in Europe and other parts of the world, where they're able to have a balanced approach to wealth and poverty.
We're looking at this long-term downward trend in child poverty across the nation and the realities here in Wisconsin with George Hinton, who's CEO of Milwaukee Social Development Commission, the community action agency tasked with helping and advocating for people in Milwaukee County living in poverty. You can join in what you see or have experienced, 800-642-1234. George, the federal poverty line, the official poverty measure in our country, you know, for a family of six, it's $37,190 a year. Why is this number so low?
I think it's too low because it doesn't reflect what it really costs to live. And if you do just above that poverty line, you're still struggling. And beyond that, and because of the competing cost just to live is not reflective of what it really means to be able to fill that first level of Maslow's needs, you know, safety, food, you know, all those types of things have to be satisfied in order for people to feel comfortable in their life and be able to make decisions that go beyond. And I just think that those lack, you know, so we need to redefine what poverty looks like in the United States. Some of my colleagues across the state really think that it's a number that was used historically. It doesn't necessarily reflect the reality of poverty across the country today.
How would you go about redefining what the economic reality of American poverty is? Because the current poverty line, it matters a lot because there are so many benefits that rely on this poverty measure.
Yeah, and that's the problem too. You know, we look at poverty from the standpoint of a line, and we think if we can just hold the line, then people are going to be okay. Well, what it does is it keeps people from being able to be successful because they know if they go beyond the line of what that assistance is, they may lose everything. It's called a cliff, and I think we have to be a little bit more sophisticated on how we build with our policies and things like that, how we build the strategy of helping people get out of poverty. People need assistance to move through the reality of poverty. If you earn a $5 more and you lose a significant benefit from the government, that's not a motivation to keep moving. It's really a strategy of it makes sense to just stay where you're at just so you're not able to so you don't disrupt whatever sense of normalcy that you have in your life and with your family. So if that makes sense, we need to rethink it really shouldn't matter what the poverty line is. What matters is how we put our policies in place to help people so they can they can truly get out of poverty and stay out of poverty.
George Hinton with us as we discuss the work to eradicate poverty in Wisconsin as the nationwide trend of children living in poverty plummets over the decades. You can join in on the challenges you see, the solutions at work in your community. Maybe you have worked with the Social Development Commission. 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We discuss American poverty statistics and this nationwide drop of children who are poor. But school nutrition leaders, they caution about the effects of the universal free school lunch program that went away at the start of this school year. Caitlin Harrison leads the School Nutrition Association of Wisconsin, telling WDJT-TV.
It makes me very nervous for families. Hunger is such a difficult thing to see.
Join in on hunger and your story, 800-642-1234. George Hinton is CEO of Milwaukee's Social Development Commission and stays with us. George, let's look more at nutrition. You mentioned it earlier. The analysis from Child Trends shows that free and reduced lunch for students in 2019 reduced child poverty by 7%. And that is before the universal school meals program that started last year ended this school year. How have free meals affected Milwaukee students?
Well, I think that we should maintain that free meals for all children. Just the fact that people, most cases, are in the public school system is an indication that they are at poverty or near poverty, especially in Milwaukee County. And it ensures that there's a safety net for our children, that there is some assurance that all children are getting a meal, despite some of the other pressures that may be impacting families at many levels of income, even beyond what we perceive to be poverty line.
The Universal School Meals Program cost the USDA $11 billion more than the previous free and reduced lunch program with income restrictions. And some are arguing that the money could be better spent in more efficient ways to address poverty. What do you think about that?
Well, I think there's some things that's an absolute that we should do. We should never compromise on taking care of our children. And I'm going to throw another one out that's not necessarily about nutrition, but, you know, lead is one of the most dangerous things affecting our children across the country. Mm-hmm. Those are things we should never compromise on. And then there are things that we can talk about doing transformative type changes that would make a difference, because I agree we're not going to just be able to move the dime by just providing transactions constantly. We're going to have to look at looking at our philosophy on how we deal with the issues of poverty from the standpoint of understanding that sometimes it's baked into the system, and how do we unbake it? But we should do that with an idea that our children come first always.
When you talk about being baked into the system and how to unbake it, I'm thinking about how pervasive myths and stereotypes about poverty are. And I'm going to, you know, say some of them now. People in poverty are lazy. They make bad decisions. Poverty is a life choice. Is there still this type of mindset out there?
Yeah, I would even go as far as to say they also think only people of color are in poverty and those types of things. And none of those are true. I mean, yes, I mean, even in the world of people who have wealth, you find people who are incompetent and lazy and all those types of things, but they're not defining people who have wealth as that, and we shouldn't define people in poverty that way, because they are all working very hard to survive. They just haven't been given some of the opportunities, maybe afforded others that have allowed people to have extended wealth that helps you be able to deal with some of the ups and downs that are natural to just life. I went to a seminar one time, talked to a lady about the problem of people having eviction, for example. And we were talking about eviction, especially from the poor community standpoint. And I recall her saying that, well, my daughter had the same issue. She had trouble. She got evicted. And then my family was able to just wrap around her and put her someplace else, give her some help around her addictions and those types of things. And then they moved on. That's not the case with people who are poor. They don't have those extended resources to keep them from spiraling out in some respects and getting worse.
Those personal family safety nets. What about poverty as a cycle? If children grow up in poverty, are they likely to live in poverty as adults?
Statistics, I think there's some evidence that shows that we have generational poverty. I grew up in poverty, and so we know it's not an absolute process. I think education is important. Again, if we concentrate on our children, we probably will do a better job of making sure that more people are able to break the cycle of poverty. Again, children, absolute investment. That's what we should think. And education should not be secondary to any other. We should have a baseline of quality for all children, and making sure that they're fed and making sure they're taken care of. And then I think we will see a difference in terms of the outcomes that we see. If you don't make the investments, right investments into young people, you're not going to see that as an outcome when they get older. And for example, lead poisoning is a negative impact on young people, and that shows up a lot of time in people who are in prison and those types of things.
George Hinton with us, CEO of Milwaukee Social Development Commission, as we unpack child poverty in America and the downward trend over the decades. Still time to talk, 800-642-1234. George, here in Wisconsin, how could government assistance programs be streamlined and strengthened and improved, in your opinion?
Like I said, we really need to be, I think we should be progressive. And I know people look at that and say, oh, my God, progressive. I don't mean it from that perspective, but innovative and progressive in terms of understanding it. We shouldn't have a cliff. It should be progressively applied to folks so people can be successful as they do better and not lose everything. I think if we can be more innovative in how we think about this from a policy standpoint, I think you'll see more people be able to then not only find themselves out of poverty, but begin to get the cycle of poverty out of the way in terms of generational poverty.
I wonder, will these historic declines in child poverty be a one-time blip, or do they, you know, hint at a new era where policymakers realize the level of poverty and hardship in America and make changes?
Well, I mean, I hope people understand, and I think people need to understand, poverty does not mean not working. People in poverty are working every day. A lot of them are working. Most are working. A large percentage of people are working. They are the essential workers that struggled during the pandemic and the ones that took a big hit because they weren't as healthy as the rest of the nation. So we need to understand that, you know, if we don't do something about some of these systems that hold people in poverty, we're going to have to deal with this from generation to generation. I don't think it's healthy for our country. And to be quite honest, it's not a very good look when we match ourselves across the world. We want democracy to be the standard for the world, then let's make sure that it looks good for all levels of our community. And it's not perceived as good for people who have means and not people who do not.
George, your commission's summit on poverty is set for next month. We only have a few seconds left, but what is the focus of this year's summit?
We're going to be talking about the pandemic and how we came out of it. What did we learn? What can we do? What can we hold on to? pretty much like talking about our children. Do we make sure that they stay in a position where they're not hungry? We need to have those kinds of discussions because we learned a lot. We were very innovative as a state, as a country during this time. And how do we hold on to some of those innovations? And how do we make sure that we as a nation don't slip right back to just same old, same old? And look for what we learned well, what we discovered, and how do we fix it? How do we make it different?
George, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for the opportunity.
George Hinton is CEO of Milwaukee's Social Development Commission. We have a link to the Child Poverty Report at WPR.org/mornings. Up ahead, medical examiners nationwide are overloaded and understaffed. We hear what the impacts of stretched forensic pathologists have on grieving families. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. News Update is next here on the Ideas Network. It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Medical examiners' offices across the country are overloaded. A Pew Trust Dateline report earlier this year says it stems from two trends that we'll dig into. More bodies coming in due to the pandemic, along with the upward trajectory of homicides, drug overdose deaths, and even traffic-related deaths. The other issue is we're not training up enough forensic pathologists to meet demand. So we'll dig into that with you, 800-642-1234. Dr. Linda Biedriski is medical examiner for Waukesha County. She's been a medical examiner for 36 years, 27 of those with Waukesha County. Dr. Biedriski, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Good morning.
Good morning. We also have Dr. Catherine Pinneri here, president of the National Association of Medical Examiners and director of Montgomery County Forensic Services in Conroe, Texas. Dr. Pinneri, welcome to you.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
Dr. Pinneri, let's start with you. As you look at this shortage at medical examiners' offices all over the country, what can you tell us about what's going on with why there aren't enough forensic pathologists?
Well, it's really an unfortunate trend, not just in forensic pathology, but in pathology in general. A lot of medical students are not selecting that as their specialty. And we've identified that one of the reasons in particular for forensic pathology is that they're just not exposed to it before they have to make a decision on what type of doctor they want to be. So the National Association of Medical Examiners has started a webinar series to try to reach out and get our field out in front of medical students in their first and second years so they have us in mind when they are choosing their specialty. But I can tell you in the United States, as of June 30th of 2021, there's only 1,485 board-certified forensic pathologists in the United States, and we're really only training about an average of 40 every year, which is not enough to fill the over 70 job openings that we have currently right now.
Step back for a moment. Performing autopsies is the first thing that comes to mind for me for the work of a forensic pathologist. Can you talk about the day in the life and the other facets of the work of these physicians?
Absolutely. So autopsies is probably the biggest part of what we do. Every day is different, which is one of the reasons I absolutely love this field. You never know what you're going to get. You can have two 30-year-old deceased individuals with completely different findings at the autopsy. But in addition to the autopsy that we perform, we also testify in court as expert witnesses. We play a big role in public health in our counties, and we interface with a lot of different agencies throughout the counties that we work for, helping the drug-related task forces understand what type of drugs we're seeing in our counties and help identify ways to prevent the drugs coming in and further deaths. We also do a lot of education and training of individuals, so we have a whole lot of different roles that each of us play in our own jurisdictions, but the autopsy is probably the number one thing.
Dr. Biedrzycki, going to Waukesha County now, what can you say about this nationwide shortage and localize it here to your county and to Wisconsin? What are we facing?
Well, in Wisconsin, most of the forensic pathologists are concentrated in the southeastern part of the state. Right now, we have 14 that I can identify practicing forensic pathologists, but they're pretty much Milwaukee, Fond du Lac, Waukesha, and Dane County. So the northern and western part of the state is very underserved. And there's not even a job opening there because there's not really a center. So you need a facility. You need infrastructure support to host this job of death investigation and autopsies. And because Wisconsin is a county-based system, we have 72 individual counties who are doing their own thing, basically. So it's really the larger populated counties in the southeastern area of the state that have centers that can that a forensic pathologist can work out of. So we have kind of two problems. We don't have enough forensic pathologists, but we don't even have locations for them to work out of to hire any forensic pathologists in areas of the state.
When you say a county's just doing their own thing, can you flesh that out for us? What do you mean there?
Well, first of all, the broader picture is every state decides how to handle medical legal death investigations. So it can be a statewide system, and that works for perhaps a state like Vermont or New Hampshire that only has a population that's less than Milwaukee County. But other states have regionalized systems. But our Constitution gives each county the authority to have its own system, and mainly they're lay medical examiners and coroners who are running death investigation systems, not forensic pathologists. So right now, I think we have about 36 lay medical examiners appointed by each county as governance, and about 27 coroners who are elected. And then we have medical examiners serving approximately six or so counties as their head agent for death investigation. The counties, it's very fragmented. Very fragmented.
Dr. Pineri, what can you say about this type of structure that you hear out of Wisconsin?
Well, that sounds very similar to what's happening in a lot of places, and there's a huge need for more forensic pathologists and trained medical examiners, but there just aren't the funds to create the facilities or the people to staff them, because there's just, quite frankly, not enough forensic pathologists. And a lot of counties are just having to make do with what they can. So they have, an elected coroner or a lay medical examiner, or in Texas we have justices of the peace that are the coroner equivalent, and they will handle the death investigations, and they aren't allowed to perform autopsies because autopsy is a medical procedure and it has to be performed by a licensed physician in a state. So what happens is they do the death investigation and decide who gets an autopsy. And sometimes, unfortunately, that decision is made based on funding, because an autopsy is expensive and the counties will have to pay for those. So sometimes it's a pick and choose based on how much money is left on in someone's budget.
Wow. We're talking about the effects of the shortage of forensic pathologists in Wisconsin, around the country. We have Dr. Catherine Pineri and Dr. Linda Biedrzycki. Dr. Pineri is president of the National Association of Medical Examiners, and Dr. Biedrzycki is medical examiner for Waukesha County. You can join in at 800-642-1234. I keep hearing the word facilities and thinking in Milwaukee, a county task force has just voted to put $20 million toward a new Center for Forensic Science and Protective Medicine that would house the medical examiner's office. Dr. Pineri would house the Office of Emergency Management. What impact do facilities have on pathology and on forensic pathology?
Oh, gosh. They are a huge part of how we function. And I can tell you from my own experience, I'm about 30 days from moving into a new facility that's been desperately needed because, quite frankly, a lot of places don't have the space to house the decedents that are going to their office. So particularly during the COVID pandemic, at the peak, we were using a refrigerated truck for decedents because we ran out of cooler space. Now, the facility you're describing sounds fantastic because the medical examiner interfaces with the Office of Emergency Management and Public Health on such a intricate level, and to have them housed in the same facility will just be fantastic for Milwaukee.
Dr. Biedriski, how do you see facilities playing into recruitment and also what you are able to do in the work?
Well, you need a facility, and I'm going to give you the example of maybe central Wisconsin, where a group of the lay medical examiners and coroners have thought about having a centralized combined facility around Marathon County. And by multiple agencies going together to fund this, and then you have a facility where you can cite a forensic pathologist, they might be able to recruit somebody. Green Bay just opened a new facility and hired a forensic pathologist to serve that part of Wisconsin. So it's kind of, if you build a facility, you might find a forensic pathologist. I mean, there are a few of us, but without a facility, you'll never find the staff to do the work. Mm-hmm. And as Dr. Panieri talked about, during the pandemic, it became really clear in Wisconsin. We had a mortuary affairs statewide call-in, like on a weekly basis, to touch base with all the people in the counties about what they were doing, what their needs were, what their resources were. Did they have enough body bags? Were there refrigeration available for the increased caseload? And it became clear that nobody was prepared for an increase. There was no resilience to the system, no capacity to the system. And everybody's sort of getting along as best they can, which is not a good place to be.
What I'm hearing is the strain was there before the pandemic, and it intensified and worsened, in the pandemic when we saw so many deaths.
Yes. Yes.
Yeah, go ahead.
Oh, I was going to say, on the western side of our state, the solution that the coroners and medical examiners found is to ship bodies to Minnesota, because eastern Minnesota is also relatively forensic pathology rich and facility rich. So rather than to transport cases to southeastern Wisconsin, which we don't really have the capacity to do more work anyway, they're sending bodies across the Mississippi to Minnesota. So yes, there is clearly a strain, and people are doing finding whatever solution they can, really.
Dr. Linda Biedriski there, medical examiner for Waukesha County. Dr. Catherine Panieri leads the National Association of Medical Examiners. Join in on the future of physicians trained to perform autopsies, investigate deaths, determine how someone died. 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We discuss the future of forensic pathology, this shortage of physicians we're hearing about in this specialty of investigating and evaluating cases of sudden, unexpected, suspicious, maybe violent death. Earlier this month, as we talked about, the Milwaukee County Medical Examiner's Office moved closer to getting a new facility in Wauwatosa, hoping that will help address a shortage. Join in on how the field of medical autopsies is changing your experiences. 800-642-1234. Dr. Catherine Panieri is president of the National Association of Medical Examiners, and Dr. Linda Biedriski is medical examiner for Waukesha County. They stay with us. I want to ask both of you something that is deeply personal, but on my mind about this career path, because Dr. Panieri, in this job, you have to see death up close in ways other people don't normally see it, and maybe every single day. What about the emotional demands of this career?
Well, it certainly has an emotional component. I think most forensic pathologists and medical legal death investigators have the ability to compartmentalize, for lack of a better word, our professional and our personal experiences. However, sometimes we see things that no one should ever have to see, and, you know, those things kind of are burned in your brain and go with you. But you learn ways to cope and deal with the emotional traumas that we see every day. We also, you know, talk with families that are going through grief experiences, and we don't know what part of that process they're going through. So we have a lot of exposure to that, and honestly, not a lot of good training in how to deal with it. But that's one thing we are currently working on, is the, you know, stress and wellness of our practitioners, so that we can better cope with what we deal with on a daily basis. But the best answer is we talk to each other because we understand what each other is going through, and we compartmentalize.
Dr. Linda Biedrzycki, you know, having worked in this field for more than 35 years, dealing with homicides and suicides, overdoses, that can be so stressful. How do you cope with that aspect of your profession?
Well, I think what Dr. Panieri said is true about compartmentalizing. We try not to take it home, but it is difficult because I don't know about other people's practice, but my practice includes being on call and being available 24/7 and going to scenes. And so it's really integrated into your life as much as you try to take it out of your life. So I think we all have to find ways to de-stress. I think that the fact that our workload has increasing is really making the ability to cope with horrible things worse, because there's less escape, if you will. You know, if my partner is sick, we have a two-person office, then, you know, I'm on call indefinitely. And so, you know, that can be pretty stressful.
Mm. Dr. Panieri, it's recommended that forensic pathologists do no more than 250 autopsies a year. In Milwaukee County, their medical examiner performed around 460 last year. What do you, you know, what do those numbers tell you? And what about the workload influence in you know, what bodies are examined?
Well, everybody's numbers have obviously gone up over the past few years. It kind of started with the opioid epidemic, you know, many years ago, and it's never gone down from that. And the more autopsies you do, the more stress you put on yourself and perhaps increase the error rate. So the cap was set at 250 as the ultimate goal, with the idea that probably most people are going to go over that, but hopefully not much. But then the absolute number that we want people to stay below is 325, because we think that's a good number for people to be able to maintain a work-life balance and provide good quality autopsies. And when the cases keep coming in, you have no choice but to either go over that number and risk losing accreditation if you are an accredited office by the National Association of Medical Examiners, or you alter your workflow. And so cases that would normally have gotten an autopsy might now just get an external examination with toxicology testing. So everyone's having to adjust to these numbers in ways that best fit their own offices.
As you look across the country, are these offices way up over 325, or does it depend from one region to the next, rural, urban?
It really just depends. Mm. I think that the some of the more urban areas that are having the highest number of violent death increases and are losing forensic pathologists to smaller, less busy offices, if there are any of those. They're seeing the stress the most and having to do the most, make the most adjustments to their caseload. So it really is just going to vary across the country. There are some offices that are more robustly staffed regularly than others, and that might be the lifestyle, the location, the facilities. So there's lots of things that would play into that. The salary, of course, would be a big one. So there are some offices that stay regularly highly staffed, but even those offices have had vacancies go unfilled for longer periods of time.
Looking at the shortage of forensic pathologists with Drs. Catherine Pineri and Linda Biedriski, still time to talk, 800-642-1234. As you look at salary, Dr. Biedriski, what changes have you seen there? I mean, this training, it requires around 13 years from undergraduate studies through your fellowship training. And you're deciding not to be in private practice. So what about salary?
Well, I've seen some jumps in a couple of areas. In Maryland, they had quite a loss of staff, including the chief, and their salaries seem to have jumped, I don't know, like 25% in the last year in order to try to attract people to this really desperate loss or short staff shortage that they had. So I won't say that across the country salaries are being elevated, but in places that really are suffering, I've seen that they're trying to address the shortage and attract people by really increasing the salaries a lot. And I think that will have to continue because it's going to be basically a bidding war for all the openings to get the fewer practitioners that are available.
We only have a few seconds left, Dr. Pineri. Do you have any advice for Wisconsin and other states that are trying to put together programs to attract more to the profession?
Well, I think, as Dr. Biedriski mentioned, facilities are number one, and you have to have a good facility to work out of. And this work is very important. It's expensive, but the constituents of your counties deserve it. And in order to have a good death investigation system, you really need a good facility run by forensic pathologists. And that's what every county, in my opinion, should strive for.
Thank you both for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Dr. Catherine Pineri is president of the National Association of Medical Examiners. Dr. Linda Biedriski is medical examiner for Waukesha County. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network.